Ecclesiastes chapter 9, reading from verses 1 to 12. So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. But no man knows whether love or hate awaits him. All share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good man, so with the sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterwards they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart. For it is now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading from his holy word. The question is posed against the background of death, and secondly, against the background of life's uncertainties. Tomorrow is an opened book. We make plans and we know what we want to do, but suddenly something happens and those plans are exploded to smithereens. The unforeseen happens. Our world is turned upside down. What then is the point of living a righteous life? This self-same question is being asked today, as it has been asked every day since this chapter has been written. And it's therefore important for us to attempt to to find an answer. In the opening verses, the preacher thinks the thoughts of the secular man after him. He says he can see no advantage in a righteous life because all men must meet death, which the secular man views as the final curtain. Look, he says, I have been around long enough to see the greatest saint and the foulest sinner, the wisest sage and the most ignorant fool, and all meet with precisely the same end. All meet with the same end. No one escapes death. This attitude to life of the secular man has devastating consequences. It produces the mad, mad world that is mentioned in verse 3, for it creates a dangerous domino effect. It produces disillusionment, and that in turn produces despair, and that in turn often finds expression in violence. Now, a careful reading of history will show that acts of violence and of vandalism against one's person or property rise proportionately in a nation as it righteousness wanes. Violence arises as righteousness wanes. Perhaps someone should say that to the men at Westminster. I have no hesitation in saying that the anger and the violence in our own society is a direct result of men being persuaded that life has no meaning, of men being persuaded that there is no God with whom they have to reckon, that life is therefore an absurdity. This whole approach to life, which is with us today, produces a dangerous morality, and this dangerous morality is outlined in verse 4. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. In other words, the quality of our lives is not as important as long as we stay alive. It is better to be a contemptible dog. And in the Middle East, the very worst thing you can call someone is a dog. It is better to be a contemptible dog who stays alive than a noble lion who is dead. Jesus said, "Blessed are you when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake." But this whole approach to life is something which today's perverse morality ridicules. It ridicules those who suffer and even die for their convictions. It shouts, "Stay alive at all costs. If it means betraying your friends, then go ahead and betray them. If it means becoming a traitor, then become a traitor. If it means denying God, carry on and do that." Life, no matter what its quality, is the only answer to the mystery of death. And therefore, do all in your power to stay alive. Now, the preacher's response to this mystery of death is found in verses 7 to 10. And we need to remember that he is not writing with the benefit of New Testament truth or with the fact of Christ's resurrection standing in front of him. Some scholars think he is quoting a well-known poem written some 1500 years before the time of writing Ecclesiastes, a poem which is a well-known epic in which a young man, bereaved, goes to the underworld to look for his dear friend. And there the doorkeeper speaks to him. And here the quotation from the poem begins in verse 7, "Go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart." He is really saying to this young, bereaved man, "Go home and get on with life." That's the world's advice for the bereaved. Go home and get on with life. You have just got to carry on. But is that all that we have to say to a bereaved person? At this point, the preacher inserts two lines of his own, lines which were meant to jar his hearers. I suppose today, if we were to insert a couple of lines of our own into a well-known Burns poem, people would sit up and say, "But that's not right. We learned that at school. That's not right. Why has he said this?" Well, to produce that kind of reaction and response, the writer adds these words of his own. Why does he do that? The great difference between the secular man and the man of faith is that the man of faith enjoys God's smile and knows it. "For it is now," notice, and this is what he adds, "for it is now God favors what you do." He's saying you are experiencing God's grace in the present. Therefore, neither be tied to the past nor spend too much time peering into the future. Learn to trust God in the present. Learn to value God's approval. We could put all of this in the form of a question. Do you this morning know that you have God's approval on your life? Do you know that this morning? Are there those here this morning who allow the mysteries of life, and death in particular, to produce doubts, which in turn cause them to keep God out? And you say, "I cannot believe or trust in God because of this or that, because of this problem or that problem. I can't believe in a God who would allow the brutal murder of a young girl in Birgeddy." But these, you see, these are the very reasons you need to believe in God. Because without him, you have no foundation for life. The second line the preacher introduces to his quotation from the epic poem is found in verse 10. "Whatever your hand finds to do, do with all your might." You see, the believer, the man of faith, knows that God has given him a task to perform. And that makes all the difference to his attitude to life. He has been liberated. He is no longer running from one roundabout to another, trying to find some satisfying meaning to his life. For the very first time, he has discovered purpose and direction in his life. Self is no longer at the center of his living. It's no longer a question of what best suits me. But rather, he is saying, how can I fulfill the royal commission that God has entrusted to me? I have a job to do for God. Do you remember Jesus' words? As long as it is day, I must do the work of him who sent me. For the night is coming when no man can work. You see, the day will come when the opportunity to work for God will have ended, and all that men and women will be left with is regret. I could have done this. I should have done that. Here then is the difference that God makes for a man who sets out in a course of righteousness in the face of the mystery of death. He knows that he has God's approval on his life. He knows that he has a royal commission that has been entrusted to him. His life has a God-given purpose. And it's that, you see, which enables him to face death with a steady eye. The second element in life which the secular man finds threatening is its uncertainty and its unpredictability. Life proves itself constantly disappointing, for it doesn't yield the expected return for all of one's endeavor. Man finds himself surrounded by circumstances over which he has no control. The unexpected happens. I don't know how many of you are able to remember the 1984 Olympics and the newspaper articles that were produced at the time. Many of the pundits in the headlines were saying, one certainty for a gold medal, Mary Decker, the fastest woman in the world. The fastest woman in the world. A chance nudge on the track knocked Mary Decker down, and the fastest woman in the world over that distance was out of contention for any medal at all. Now, the woman was devastated. If you saw her being interviewed after the race, she was meant to win the gold. Everyone said she should. She was the fastest woman in the world. It was obvious that this should have happened. But the chance card was played. A chance nudge knocked her down. Now, the writer's aim here is to show that though life seems, as we were saying to the children earlier, as though life seems to be a game of monopoly, where we're constantly being dealt chance cards, things over which we have no control, things which we never expected to happen to us, things which constantly create baffling and heart-breaking breaking circumstances, despite all of that, life is not a game of monopoly. For the man of faith is able to see in some measure God in control of life's unpredictable circumstances. And that very fact is a tremendous encouragement to him when the chance card, so-called, is played. God's sovereignty to him becomes a great truth on which he falls back. Think for a moment about God's sovereign control. Think of a little shepherd boy who challenged the most powerfully equipped soldier of the Philistine military machine. Absurd that a young boy could defeat a military champion. But a stone did it. A chance stone? Not a bit of it. God is the sovereign ruler of history. Goliath fell, and you can be sure that the bookies on both sides that day made a killing. No one would have put their money on David. But you see, God is in charge of history. Remember, too, that the preacher was addressing a nation that lived under the shadow of a succession of superpowers who had complete political and military supremacy. Israel at the time had no defense spending in her budget. If war were to break out, the very best that Israel could do would be to get together some sort of dad's army. Not much more than that. And we find the sovereignty of God illustrated in Israel's history. At one juncture, the cream of Israel were taken off captive to Assyria, and its king Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by his son Belshazzar, and he considered himself to be thoroughly secure in the great city of Babylon. He felt so secure that as his armies went out to battle, he decided to hold a party in his capital, thinking to himself that if the absurd were to happen and my armies were defeated, I am safe here in Babylon, because I am in a city which has 14 miles of walls around it. Three walls, one after another. And these walls are 100 feet high. I am safe and secure. But he miscalculated. Those of his own people whom he had offended betrayed him to the enemy, and they opened the doors and they let the enemy into the capital city. Isn't there a word for us here? A great many people fear what might happen in history. A great many people fear nuclear threat and superpowers. They mistrust arms agreements. But the writer says the race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong. Why? Because there is a sovereign God who is in control of history. That fatal button that has some people's knees knocking together cannot be pushed without the divine permission of God. And the man of faith should take great comfort in that. Yes, there are unforeseen circumstances in life, but they are the commonplace servants of God. There is a word here for a small congregation, for a weak national church. The secular world may laugh at the church because she seems so weak and so insignificant. She may ridicule the way in which secular thinking has deprived the church of any power or witness. The night before last, I watched a former moderator of the Church of Scotland say that as far as homosexual and lesbian relationships were concerned, he felt that was okay as long as there was a measure of commitment in the relationship. Now, what had happened there? He had allowed secular thinking to influence his theology. And what should be happening is the church should be employing its theology to influence, first of all, the behavior of those within her walls and ranks, and influence the behavior of society. And the world does laugh at a church that is deprived of the power of witness. The church that was once ablaze, that was consumed with a passion for God's glory, is seen today as a spent force. The fire has gone, and we're left with a few fitful coughs of smoke here and there. Her buildings are seen by speculator and developer alike as fit for nothing more than furniture stores and bingo halls and restaurants. And interestingly enough, this former moderator that I mentioned earlier, his church is being used, I believe, to be developed for flats at the present moment in time. But you see, the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the strong. God's word tells us that he does not despise the smoking fire, for it can be ignited again. He is the Lord of history. I can still remember the excitement that was stirred in my heart when I read for the first time a famous little Tamil proverb which says, "A blade of grass is a mighty weapon in the hand of God." The world may despise a blade of grass. It may ridicule a blade of grass, but in the hand of God, it's a mighty weapon. Do we believe that this morning? God has his own agenda for the church. No matter what men may think of it or how many may write it off, these words of verse 11 can be applied at a personal level. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. We may see ourselves this morning as not particularly gifted individuals. There may be some here carrying a huge inferiority complex on their shoulders. What can I possibly do for God? How can I possibly serve him? I'm a nobody. With my background, I could never be of any value or use to God. let me remind you that Jesus did not choose the swift and the strong to be his disciples. He did not choose the wise and the wealthy and the men of great reputation to be his disciples. He chose flawed fishermen who, despite their many failures, advanced the cause of Christ and were his instruments in building the church. Blades of grass, mighty weapons in God's hand. For the race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong. You see, God's sovereign control is a great leveler, for both the strong and the weak are subject to God's circumstances. Secular man is unsettled by the fact that his life is surrounded by circumstances over which he has no control. But the man of faith has a deep-seated assurance. When time and circumstance seem to be against, he knows a deep conviction that God is the God of all chance, so-called, and circumstances. These are his ordinary messengers and are to be welcomed as such. Why are you here this morning? Because the heating in the church broke down. No. Why are you here this morning? Mere time or chance? Not a bit of it. It is no accident. No accident. It is God's time and chance for you to hear his voice and to experience his power. Is it time for you to open up your life and your heart to him? Perhaps, like the secular man mentioned in Ecclesiastes, you have been keeping God at a distance for all sorts of plausible reasons. Is it God's time for you this morning to open up your heart and your life to him? The writer to the Hebrews says, today, if you hear his voice, harden not your heart. May God speak clearly to each one of us. We bring our service to its close by singing